With a 50% obesity rate in the U.S. and more unhealthy people than ever before, it is time to make America healthy. Welcome to Make America Healthy with Beth Shaw. If you're feeling tired, toxic, heavy, slow, or stressed, then keep listening. Beth and her expert guests are here to offer practical advice and share the tools you need to reclaim your physical, mental, and emotional health. Now, here is your host, Beth Shaw.
Happy Wednesday, everyone, and thank you so much for tuning in to Make America Healthy. On Make America Healthy, we tackle anything related to health and wellness, physical and mental. And in honor of May, Mental Health Awareness Month, the topic of today's show is when mental health problems go untreated. So mental health affects our emotional, physical, social well-being. It also affects how we feel, we think, we act. And it's important at every stage of life, from childhood to adolescence through adulthood. When mental health problems go untreated, the substance abuse problems that people have sometimes get worse. And then when alcohol or drug abuse increases, mental health problems usually increase too. So we've got a lot to unpack today. Our first guest is Dr. Judy Grizel, who used to abuse alcohol in middle school, then became a daily drug user, taking every addictive substance she could find on the street, which is where she spent most of her time. Towards the end of her life, a friend made an observation that there will never be enough cocaine, describing the hopeless state that substance abusers often have. So Judy is very interesting because she studies neuroscience in humans and in mice, and we're super excited to have her on. So we're going to go from a macro view to a micro view today. We're also going to speak with Durga Leela, who is a longtime person in recovery and will bring us the Ayurvedic cures and hope, and also from a yogic perspective. So we also have with us today Dr. Maria Karakla, who is joining us from Cyprus to talk about mental health around the world. Dr. Judy, tell us a little bit about your story and give us a kind of a top-line view of the neuroscience of addicts versus non-addicts, and just, you know, help us understand the brain a little bit more.
Sure. That has been the focus of my research efforts and my interest for the past 40 years or so. When I ended up in a treatment center at 23 after abusing substances and kind of losing everything, including respect for myself, I got to treatment and was told that if I wanted to be well, I needed to be sober and clean. And I thought, no way, there's got to be a different solution than that. I did not want any part of that. So I figured, and this is like the height of arrogance, because I just figured, well, they're telling me I have a disease, I'll cure the disease, and then I'll be able to use. So my motivation for becoming a neuroscientist was really so that I could take drugs without self-destructing. And only someone who was as determined as I was to use drugs would think of such a crazy thing, because I was not, I'd been kicked out of three schools, I was homeless, you know, I was kind of a very big mess. But anyway, it took me a while. I took 7 years to get my undergraduate, and then another 7 to get my PhD, and then I did a postdoc, and anyway, all the while hoping. So
were you still using drugs and alcohol during that
no,
time?
No, I got, if I was using, I would not go to school. No, that's how I felt, you know, got kicked out of all the schools. So I'm kind of an extreme person. So I just took my obsessive compulsive addictive nature and applied it toward useful things, which I thought was science. And science is very interesting, as is living on the streets. And it takes a lot of persistence and curiosity. And I had those things. So I guess, at any rate, this is what I can say. There are three main causes of substance use disorders from my perspective. One is what we inherit, you know, a sort of a liability in our brain, and genetics and epigenetics probably account for about half the risk. It's very complicated. There's not a gene for addiction or even a couple of them. There's probably hundreds of genes that influence the tendency to take and then appreciate addictive substances. There's also a lot of environmental factors, and those kind of fall into two categories, I would say, two major categories. One is just access and opportunity in the culture for anybody. Also, stress and trauma kind of count on that. So if you're trying to self-medicate, I won't go on and on here, but you know, then they're more appealing. But the third factor is early use. So adolescence is a particularly kind of sour spot for developing addiction. About 90% of the people who take addictive drugs excessively, no, let me say, about 90% of people who have substance use disorders started using before they're 18.
So in the theme of today's show, because we're talking about, you know, when mental health problems don't get treated, would you say that addiction is just lying on top of these mental health issues that aren't treated? So it's in essence, people's way of treating their mental health issues?
Well, I agree with what you said earlier. So addiction is a mental health disorder, and it makes other ones worse, especially depression and anxiety. And also, depression and anxiety predispose someone toward substance use disorders as a way of self-medicating. Right. So they really feed each other.
Now, I can relate to your story because I had my first bit of wine when I was 10 years old. And I grew up in New York City. So we probably did a lot of things that we shouldn't have. You know, smoking our parents' weed when we were 12, doing other things at nightclubs when I was 16. Yet, you know, I never turned into an addict. So I asked you before we started the show today, like, is there a marked difference between the brain of an addict and a non-addict? And is there any way for them to tell, like, if people were to get early brain scans to see who has a propensity towards addiction? Because once, you know, you introduce the drug and alcohol into the brain, I've seen enough slides to see that the brain definitely does change, and not for the better.
No is the answer. So okay. We're much more similar than we are different.
Okay.
No.
So there's not like an addict's brain versus a non-addict's brain.
No, this is the problem with all behavioral disorders, including depression and anxiety, by the way. It's not like diabetes. You can't do a blood test. Can't look at the cells like you can with cancer. Behavioral disorders, mental health disorders are squiffy. And so they, you know, vary continuously in a population. It's hard to say who has a problem or who doesn't. My short description is that if the costs of your using outweigh the benefits, then it's irrational. Then it's a, you know, disordered use.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, most things in life boil down to cost-benefit analysis at the end of the day. So I like that. That's a good. I'm running an online group right now called SOS, Sort of Sober, and it's a one-month program to try to help people reduce their alcohol consumption down. And we've got actually we're meeting right after this, but you know we've got people in the group who drink a bottle of wine every day. We've got other people who just drink casually on the weekends, but they want to take it down. We've got some people who are in recovery, but they may have fallen off the wagon trying to get back on. So we definitely have a mixed group of people, all with the intent of just wanting to consume less for better health. Dr. Maria Caracalla, welcome, joining us from Cyprus. And she is a clinical psychologist and does behavioral medicine. And she focuses on health promotion and all sorts of things. And she's doing a lot of good work in clinical psychology. Welcome from Cyprus.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So in the vein of mental health issues that go untreated, do you want to talk a little bit about it and what your research has focused on in this area?
Sure. We do a lot of work with different kinds of mental health and behavioral type problems and how those impact individuals' health or how health then or health type or health related problems, how they impact individuals' mental health. I do a lot of work with different types of addictions as well, and especially smoking. And we work a lot with craving being one of the kind of like main contributors that people talk about when they talk about having difficulty stopping a lot of these behaviors that individuals have. Now, mental health difficulties have been demonized a lot in our societies. So a lot of what we also work on is to kind of like start to see that a lot of these problems may have a function for the person. So they serve some sort of purpose when the person, especially these behaviors, they served some sort of purpose for the person when they started, for example, using or when they engaged in some of these behaviors that may create problems for them in the long run. So we try to look for that and then help the individual start to connect with the things that are important to them and how they can like capitalize on their values and what gives meaning to their life so that they can start then to make changes in their lives.
Well, I have another question for both Dr. Maria and Dr. Judy. And that is, I was talking with some family members the other night about different psychological diagnoses from the DSM, whether it's bipolar, borderline personality, you know, and some of the conversation was people just didn't like those diagnoses. Some people in the room thought, okay, there's gray areas in between. I'm curious for both of you, what do you think about the current diagnosis scale, if you will, or you know, the DSM? And do you find that they're accurate? Are there different blends that people have? Are these things easy to diagnose? I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who are walking around undiagnosed. Do you need a psychologist or a psychiatrist to diagnose them? Give us some insight.
I can respond. I have a lot to say about this, and I do a lot of work in this area. It depends on what the purpose of diagnosis is. And if the purpose of getting a diagnosis or utilizing this types of categorical approaches to classify individuals or classify mental disorders is to facilitate communication among practitioners, to assist clinical assessment by providing clear symptom categories, aid research by providing distinct diagnostic groups against which clinical populations can be compared, or to facilitate reimbursement for services, then yeah, maybe there's a purpose there. But if the purpose of these systems is to understand the reasons underlying psychopathological problems so as to guide treatment, then I believe that such very reductionistic, very biomedical type models do not work well and have failed. Because if we consider the reality of clinical practice, along with extensive research findings that document that there is substantial symptom overlap among clinical disorders, high rates of comorbidity, heterogeneity, the most common diagnosis is the not otherwise specified condition.
So that's a big catch-all.
Oh, yeah. Unclear boundaries between categories, poor diagnosis reliability, and most importantly, an uncoupling of diagnosis from case conceptualization and treatment. So I believe, and a lot of colleagues working in the area of contextual behavior science believe that it's time to start to move away from such systems and start to explore new ways of not necessarily categorizing individuals, but start to become more sensitive in terms of what sort of core biopsychosocial processes need to be targeted with individual suffering, so that we can start to look at what goals they have, in what situations, and how can we efficiently and effectively change these.
Great, thank you. Dr. Judy, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I agree with everything Maria just said. I think that we do not understand mental illness from the scientific perspective. And I speak, you know, NIH, the National Institutes of Health, does not understand. The American Medical Association does not understand. And that is part of the reason why the incidence and the suffering from mental health disorders, including addiction, continue to go up. So all this research, all these papers written, all these medicines made, and the impact is not there. It's because it's complicated. Human beings are complicated. And as we just heard, they're not going to fit into these categories. We can't look at a brain scan and say who's depressed and who's anxious and who's got a problem with cocaine. So I think, you know, these are useful in to some degree, but they're not helping.
Great. Thank you. That's very insightful. I have another question for both of you, and that is, because our subconscious is running so much of our lives, where does that intersect with a diagnosis? And not just the subconscious, but also, you know, the ensuing behaviors that may come along with any of these diagnoses, and how do we really, if someone was diagnosed as bipolar or borderline personality or schizophrenic, narcissistic personality disorder, like, where does the cure come in? Because I know that medication doesn't 100% work. And I also, you know, think that there is huge value in talk therapy. However, a lot of times talk therapy doesn't really control people's knee-jerk responses or daily behaviors. Is there an answer?
I can start there because I don't have so much to say. But again, if we don't understand it, separating conscious and unconscious isn't necessarily helpful. I agree with the idea of taking the person where they are and trying to help them address and change their behaviors. But I think that, you know, you mentioned a whole bunch of things, from personality disorders to mood disorders to substance use disorders. And I think those have different substrates in many cases. So I guess I'm going to turn it over to Maria, whose expertise is probably.
Thank you.
It's a very complicated question to respond to. And I guess it also depends on which kind of like theoretical approach you come from. From my perspective, I care more about function of behavior and what sort of functions different behaviors serve individuals, and how can we go about exploring those, understanding those, and then figuring out ways to help the person address issues that may come up and interfere with, you know, living the life they want to be living. So whatever the label we want to give them, I personally don't care about the label that we would give them. I care more about, you know, the sort of behaviors that are creating trouble for individuals. A lot of times what we would call unconscious would be individuals doing conditioned behaviors. So things that they've learned and had long histories of repeating. So in that respect, it's not necessarily that it's something unconscious, but it's more habitual and something that they may do mindlessly and not really be aware when these things occur, just because they weren't paying attention to them, or they just have been doing this for a very long time. So when I have, for example, a person facing difficulties with you know, we mentioned earlier, drugs or smoking or alcohol, and they find themselves holding a cigarette or holding a drink, and they were like, oh my God, I did this without even thinking about it unconsciously. Well, in reality, it's because you've reached to grab this so many times in this context that it, you know, becomes a habit of doing it. So you may not even be paying attention when that happens. I don't know if any of this makes
sense. No, it totally makes sense. And I love that you said mindless, because I've partook in a variety of psychological processes throughout the course of my life, including CBT and DBT. And really the focus of those two methodologies is being mindful and kind of catching yourself before a reaction or an action, and really walking the path of mindfulness. And when we come back after the break and speak with Durga, we're going to talk more about how yoga creates mindfulness and yoga therapy, and Ayurveda can lend the cure. So as we move deeper into the mind, at what point do you feel like people can heal themselves versus seeking outside counsel? I'm just saying this because I have a family member who's been seeing the same psychologist for upwards of 25 years, and really still struggles with a lot of the same issues. And, you know, the other day I said to her, maybe it's time to become your own therapist and take matters into your own hands. Thoughts or comments on that?
With addiction, I can say that it's really unsuccessful.
Okay.
And I personally feel like no one does anything themselves. I really benefit from all kinds of support in my own recovery and in my mental health status. So I feel like we need each other, and maybe, you know, that doesn't mean that every person is equally helpful, maybe somebody else, but I think it's tough. The world is tough. There's a lot of people suffering, and I personally don't have a lot of faith in the, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps notion.
Great. Dr. Judy, thank you for that perspective. What about you, Dr. Maria?
Yeah, well, if we think about the World Health Organization has a figure that's like a stepped care that some individuals may be able to, you know, depending on what the problem is and the difficulties they're facing, they may be able to manage certain things by themselves or using their social support network and system, but others may need different levels of support along the way. Nowadays, we have a lot of success with like digital interventions or self-help type of, you know, books or material and so on, that, you know, some individuals would be helped by just, you know, having such engaging with such types of therapies or interventions themselves. But we see that not all people can achieve these and may need more and may need more intensive types of interventions and therapies. But when I heard you say about the person that's seeing the same psychologist for so many years, I have a reaction there that if you've been doing this and it hasn't helped, maybe it's time to make a change. Whether that's a change of psychologist or a change of treatment or some sort of change, because if you continue to do what you've done, and you're going to get the same outcome, you're not going to get anything new. So something needs to change here to get a different outcome.
Right, right. That's a definition of insanity to keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result. Or you're living in the land of a lot of hope, which I think a lot of people also do. So we're going to go to a break to thank our sponsors, and then we're going to come back and talk about solutions. And we're going to talk with Durga Leela, who is also a person in long-term recovery. So we'd like to thank our sponsors, globalhealing.com, a great company that makes supplements, natural, organic, and they make Oxy Powder, which is a powerful oxygen-based colon cleanser, because up to 20 pounds of undigested waste could be residing in your colon. So they have a great Oxy Powder formulation based on one of Tesla's formulas, and they have gut detox programs, every different vitamin you can imagine. I have been to their factory, and I swear by their products. They're family-owned, organic, and backed by science and nature, run by Dr. Edward Group. So you can save 15% at globalhealing.com. Just enter the code YOGAFIT15 at checkout. I'll be doing their liver cleanse next week. So if you'd like to join me again, go to globalhealing.com and put in the code YOGAFIT15 to save. And we'd also like to thank our sponsor, YogaFit Training Systems Worldwide, the largest yoga school in the world, offering all different types of corporate wellness programs, over 150 different yoga and mind-body education programs, running conferences and trainings. And you can save 15% at checkout at yogafit.com by entering the code VOICE22. So check out some yoga, because we're going to be talking about it right now with Durga Lee, who is not only in long-term recovery and a certified Ayurvedic practitioner and yoga therapist, but she also is the director for the Ayurvedic programs at the Shivananda Ashram, which I've been to. It's where I did my first wheel pose. She's been the director of Ayurvedic programs at Shivananda Ashram since 2003. Durga, welcome.
Thank you, Beth. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you again. I believe we've met at some yoga conference somewhere.
Yes, yoga therapy conference.
Yes.
And namaste, Judy and Maria. Wonderful to hear you speak. And your training is amazing. So I'm glad we have all these different levels of help available.
So did you start practicing yoga before you went into recovery or afterwards?
I did, before I went into recovery. And it was purely a physical practice.
Great. And what prompted you to get into recovery?
The death of my mother, which I viewed as a direct consequence of alcoholism, and losing my job as a rebound effect of the grief that I was in over that, no longer able to hold it together, which I had spent an enormous amount of energy trying to hold it together. But in truth, what I was trying to hold together was a successful life that was designed to make my mother better. So I was, you know, getting all the success and things that I was supposed to in the hope that it would heal her. So when it did not, then I really started to slide rapidly into bottom. And then I did a big geographic, and I moved from London, where I was working, to Lake Tahoe, Northern California. And, you know, there I got to really kind of act out with no constraints. And so I hit bottom. I did not go to rehab. I just stepped into a 12-step group, and I experienced over maybe 2 years a gradual spiritual awakening.
Interesting. How has Ayurveda helped you in your recovery? And probably tell our listeners what Ayurveda is, and then how it can be helpful, not just for people who are struggling with a substance abuse issue, but also struggling with any mental health issue, because again, today's topic is mental health problems that go untreated. Where does Ayurveda fit into all of this?
Yeah, the way I see Ayurveda, I really do believe it is one of the best behavioral health care medicine systems on the planet. And that's because it links us back directly to nature. It says that, you know, the material manifestation of who we are is a representation of five elements. It describes qualities. It knows us to be consciousness, but then consciousness manifest. So we are spiritual beings, but we are sense-based and social beings. And so all of its recommendations take into account the rhythms of the planet, the cohesiveness of us as people within communities, within different environments, and within different micro-environments of different constitutions. And so different recommendations will have different effects on different people, depending on their stage of life, depending on their constitution. So it's a system of medicine that has a very macro view, but can personalize recommendations down to the particular way we manifest imbalance. Does that answer?
Yes, that certainly does. Now, I wrote a book called Yoga Lean, and it was based on Ayurveda. And in that book, it's a healthy lifestyle program, otherwise known as a weight management program. And in Yoga Lean, we give different fitness and nutrition prescriptions to the different doshas, different constitutions, as you said, Vata, Pitta, and Kapha. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about each Ayurvedic constitution and perhaps some mental health hacks that they can take depending upon their constitution or dosha?
Yeah, I'll do that as best I can in a few moments. So the active elements of Vata are primarily air, and this gives them qualities of having, like, feeling cold, being lighter, both in their actual physical body and also in their mind qualities, and definitely mobility, like the air moves things. So this gives them a certain tendency towards physical and mental emotional imbalances. Some of the words that we use for their tendency around mental emotional stuff is they tend towards worry, anxiety, fear, fright. They have sometimes difficulty with holding steady their attention or their actual body. They've got a lot of kinetic energy in them. So four words that we use to help them, it helps them to bring in some idea of regularity without being rigid. Routine, so asking them to ground themselves with sleep and meal times where they, you know, they can bring that air down to the ground and be grounded. Warmth, because they're cold, and warmth means, like, carry a scarf, especially when you're in hotels and you're in that chill factor of AC. And oil, because they really suffer from dryness. So dehydration is a huge factor in all these health concerns that we're talking about. Dehydration, particularly within the site of accumulation of this particular energy, which is the large intestine, which contributes to gas and pain and bloating. And that's a very uncomfortable thing to live with. And it will have its psychological effect, like the psychological effect will have its effect on the body. Moving to the next dosha, primary element of Pitta is fire. So they are not suffering from the cold. They're more heated. They're more likely to lash out. They're a little bit more likely to kind of be aggressive, show anger, show irritability, criticism, intolerance. And so what we're doing with that is we're trying to recognize that heat at the mind-body level, bring it down. So chronic inflammation is one of the stories, but health right now. So we're giving them a lot of cooling things. There's so many different ways we can cool people down, not just with temperature, but with actual qualities of food. So there's fire foods, for instance, get rid of the garlic, less salt, less sugar, because it's highly inflammatory. And then moving to the next one, we've got Kapha, primarily water. Water has very different qualities than air and fire. So it's cold like air, but it's heavy and it's slow and it's dense. And so these people show more of a kind of sedentary, passive, nostalgic, sentimental, overly emotional, and perhaps overly attached, not so ready to change. And so with them, we use techniques, and this is across all five senses and all the different yoga practices and techniques, where we can lighten them up, get them moving, and really kind of get that storehouse of energy that their mind-body system is, get it moving. And once they're moving, they're pretty good at keeping going, an endurance level that they have.
Great. So obviously these three doshas have a different psychological outcome or manifestation. And once you're using Ayurveda to kind of balance things out, are you seeing a big improvement in their mental health?
Yeah, and I think partly how I recognize that I do that is because we have a disease-based medical model, then I think it's important that holistic models come in and they describe us from our more balanced, stable, core, essential self. And I think each person has a connection to what they would call their better self, their best intentions, their better like felt sense of when they feel okay within themselves. And so I call this describing their potential and not always 100%, you know, rehashing the pathology states that we can get to. So the potential of those doshas is to be great artistic communicators, healers, guides, leaders, and really like patient, loyal earth mothers. And when I say that, that is the potential of all of us, because once we develop a more connected idea of who we are and a more gentle, compassionate self-acceptance to who we are and also who you are, like your tendency to reactive states. And I create a pause around that so I don't have to react to like the people around me. That's very important because we are social. Then there's that ability then to be more grounded, be established in the self is one of the words that we use in Ayurveda. And I think that helps a great deal because it's something that we want to bring to mind and really have a sense of every day. So we want to remind people that the lashing out and the anger is really misdirected leadership and you know, rational, great thinkers. So we want to change it back to the positive.
Great. As someone who's pretty reactive, I will say thank you to that last statement. I'm also curious, do the different doshas have, you know, is one more prone to a substance or alcohol abuse issue? Do people with different doshas, if they do get into addiction, crave different things? I'm very curious about this. Can you connect some of these lines for us?
Yes, we could definitely say that when a dosha is imbalanced, it will pursue more of its own qualities. So the idea of our medicine system is to find balance, and that's always available to us. But when the dosha is driving the bus, then it will tend to seek out things that increase its primary quality. So air people tend to get even more restless. They tend to get more multitasking, doing too many things. So anything that will increase that is something that they would feel drawn towards. But then they also need to bring that down a notch. So I want to say that there's this idea that with the spread addiction that we're dealing with in our chronic modern addictiveness, it's like you could ask a person with addictive disorder, what's your drug of choice? And the answer would be, what have you got? Because I will use anything to change how I feel. And it's because how I feel is no longer connected to my stable sense of self. So the fire people, yes, maybe they are more inclined towards alcohol. They love coffee. They love sugar. Anything that gives them intensity and focus to increase their efficiency and effectiveness. They like to get a lot done. They're into power. They're into, you know, just being able to run things. And that's a good trait, but they can take it too far in workaholism. And then the water type, Kapha, they kind of enjoy comfort. They enjoy friends and family. So they want anything that holds that together. So they might get a little emotionally manipulative. They definitely have that feeling of being unable to let go. So if I was to say they suffer with congestion on a physical level, and then you can usually see it around them if you open their cupboards that's packed full of food, or their other cupboards in their house are packed full of little mementos that they can't get rid of. It's they're really sentimental, and they'll start to accumulate and hoard things in their life.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you watch that show Hoarders, which I watch on occasion, most of the people on Hoarders are actually look pretty overweight. And in my book, Yoga Lean, I mentioned that excess weight on the body is no different than being a hoarder of stuff. You're just putting too much food in your system, or you wouldn't have a weight problem. So that's very interesting that you should say that. So I'm assuming kind of like Vata, the air people, would go for things that are going to make them more airy, maybe smoking some weed. The Pitta people may go for alcohol or cocaine. The Kapha people might be more prone to abuse pain pills and things of that nature. Am I on track here?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's amazing because the Kapha people might want muscle relaxants when generally we would think they're quite laid back already. But I often say that then they want to merge with the couch. Whereas, you know, Vata wants to take on full flight capacity to be able to move quickly in any direction at any time. So like in Yoga of Recovery, we definitely focus in on two aspects, which is food and people. And we say that's the base addictive disorders. And everybody is acting out a little bit there. So the Vata people tend to get towards restrictive eating disorders because the lightness of their own nature. Pitta people aspire to that because of the lightness of their own nature, but that fire gives them a pretty ferocious hunger level. So they will tend to be able to eat a certain way in public and then maybe act out a little bit more in secret where they have their like less favored food, like, you know, they're not so much in control. So then they might go towards binging and purging. And then Kapha people tend to just kind of emotionally overeat. And when it comes to people, I'll say it in three sentences. Vata people tend to think a little insecure. So they tend to think, you know better than me what I should do. And if they team up with a Pitta, that's great, because Pitta thinks I know better than you what you should do. And then with Kapha, they kind of have this like deep attachment. So it's, you are my reason for living. So therefore I can only live if you're here. Like that emotional manipulation, like classic codependency.
So there's a lot of psychological implications around all of the doshas. Tell us, because you're also a yoga therapist, and we have a yoga therapy program at YogaFit. I just sent hoodies to our first round of graduates from our IAYT yoga therapy program. Our mental health system, I think we can all agree, is very overloaded right now. And there is a lot of medication use and misuse happening right now, especially in the United States. Are we seeing more of a trend towards more natural healing, yoga therapy, Ayurveda? Where should people go to search out such practitioners? And what does the future of mental health look like? And I'd like you to all answer that from your corner of the world, from Cyprus to California to somewhere in Pennsylvania. Dr. Judy, do you want to start?
Sure. I think it looks like a capacity to live our fullest, highest life. That's mental health to me. Was that the question?
That's definitely a great answer. I'm, you know, just kind of wondering what your thoughts are on the expand of mental health offers.
Yeah.
In a world that's overrun with pills. Burnt out therapists right now.
So, as I'm not a therapist, but I do think that the epidemic of drug abuse undermines our fullest lives by kind of exploiting our desire to cope and making things actually worse. So we are in this vicious cycle where, you know, I want to escape from my life, but the more I use, the more I need to get out of my life. So from the addiction perspective, I think one thing that would really help, and maybe not particularly with therapists, but with all of us, is to have more models that demonstrate healthy coping, whether that is therapy or meditation or yoga or Ayurveda or whatever it is. I think we don't have, you know, how do people cope? It's hard. And they cope by using something. If it's not a chemical, it's a phone or a gambling or, you know, excessive.
It's funny you should say that. I watched someone over the weekend, like literally glued to their phone for 2 days.
It's sad. It's an addiction.
And I was just like, hello, are you present? And I know the dopamine, you know, receptors were probably fired to the point of exhaustion. But yeah, the phone definitely is an addiction. And sometimes people who have had other addictions and then they transfer their addictions onto the phone.
So help with coping.
Help with coping. Dr. Maria, tell us from another country, you know, what you're seeing with mental health right now. And is it mirroring what the huge problems we have here in North America?
Yes, unfortunately, I think it's we've just lived through a whole pandemic, and I think mental health problems is a whole like other parallel pandemic happening. So we definitely see this as huge issue, not only in my country, Cyprus, but in other countries in Europe and, of course, the US and even in developing countries, we see these being problems coming through. I mean, the whole issue of immigration, migration, and like all of the refugees we have in the world. I mean, there's so much suffering, unfortunately, around our planet that we do see mental health issues being major problems in people's lives. And yeah, traditional medicine and, you know, the way we've been approaching things has not, you know, relieved this suffering, has not provided cures for things. So exploring things outside of the box and going back to, I really like what Judy said about, you know, finding what would work for somebody to help alleviate their suffering, to help them cope with the difficulties they're facing in a more adaptive way, then whatever works, you know, that would be great.
Great. Thank you so much, Durga. I'd like you to share with our listeners how awesome yoga is and yoga therapy and how it can be such a valuable part of one's own mental health treatment program.
Yeah. So one of the things about yoga therapy is that it is treating the person in front of them, not the disease. So it's treating a whole person. It situates the person back into a seat of witness and joy, the ability to have a longer term view on things. I would say one of the things that we talk about in yoga recovery is that addiction currently is diagnosed as a chronic relapsing brain disease. So it's diagnosed as a brain disease, but it is experienced as a heartbreak and a heartache out here in our society, in our communities. That's why it has such a ripple effect, because I've always been interested, and it was good to hear Judy talk about, you know, all this massive technology. We are social beings. We are sense-based beings. We know how to sit in a circle together. And when we hear someone's story, we know how to hold space for them. And even when you don't know how to do that, it's amazing how quickly you will learn how to do it when other people are exampling it there for you. So I think the biggest move in mental health in particular is that we have to move away from the over-professionalization of the healthcare system, you know, where we're born in hospitals and we're encouraged to die in hospitals, and everything else in between is meant to be treated by these licensed clinical professionals. But we're living out here in our social gatherings, and there is a way, and it's very well proven, that support groups, peer support groups that don't have any particular professional within the room, they're a great help, but also there's a continuum of care that's needed. So I think initially there might need to be the medication-assisted detox, the medication-assisted treatment. There has to be some level of professional help moving out into the community. So community resource organizations that are being supported by SAMHSA, those are the people who are actively looking for yoga teachers, yoga therapists. They're involved with the yoga recovery conversations. People are training recovery coaches because this makes it more affordable. This makes it more like there's just someone there who understands where you are. So I think a continuum of care and all the different levels of care. And if I can say, one of the best things that I ever heard was I visited a mental hospital, Ayurvedic mental hospital in India. And there I found a research paper that was about how developing nations have better outcomes than Western nations with specific mental health. And the reason it was posited was because they had choice of treatment. And so this like one size fits all really doesn't work, especially Great. In the mental health world.
Thank you. We're going to leave it there with choice of treatment. I like that. I like to say when I teach yoga, the one with the most options wins. And definitely, I think with mental health, the same thing can be said. So once again, I would like to thank our guests, Dr. Judy Grizel, Durga Leela, and Dr. Maria Karakla. And YogaFit has some great conferences coming up where you can do all types of different yoga. So please go to yogafit.com to check those out. We also certify recovery coaches. And please visit me at bethshaw.com or on Instagram, Bethshaw Health. We can continue this conversation of mental health because I believe it's one we're going to be having for years and years, as the evidence of the past 2 years shows us that we all need to take our mental health into our own hands and work together with whoever can be a support system in that process. Yoga communities, counselors and yoga therapists, Ayurveda for sure. Thank you so much, everyone. Have a great rest of your day. And thank you for helping make America healthy and make the world healthy. A big namaste to you all. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Make America Healthy. We hope we've given you some tools you need to take back control of your health. Until next time, we wish you a healthy and wonderful week.